Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Alison Weir, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi there, Donna.
This is publication day one. One of six.
Very exciting.
Exactly. So you're doing a series of the six Tudor queens, starting with, obviously, the first, Catherine of Aragon.
Yes, that's right.
The true queen.
That's how she would have seen herself. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at the canon law that was at play in the controversy over her marriage, you will see that she was, in fact, the true queen. And I'm really sticking my neck out over that.
Excellent. Stick it out. I would like you to read, and I wanted to ask you about this dedication.
Yes, I named my daughter for Catherine. And the book is dedicated to my mother, so it goes on, because Catherine was a woman of integrity and principle, as you are. And that's what shines forth about Catherine of Aragon. I'm not so sure my daughter was impressed. She said, you haven't named me for some old queen, have you? But, no, I mean, that's what's always attracted me to Catherine of Aragon. She suffered for a principle, for what she thought was right. And what more can we do on this earth? Mm-hmm. And you can only admire her because, and when I say she suffered, she really did. She lost everything that meant anything to her. And she went through severe tribulations, and yet right to the last she maintained she was right. And she also continued to love the king, even though he had treated her very badly.
Yes. Catherine of Aragon, there were three things mm-hmm. of superb importance to her, as you say. Spain.
Yes.
England and the king.
Yes, Henry.
Yes, as bound together.
Her lawful husband, yes, absolutely.
And being a mother.
Her daughter, yes, whose rights she fiercely protected. And Henry, of course, wanted a son, which Catherine couldn't give him. And he had no perception that a female ruler could rule successfully. It was seen as unnatural for a woman to wield dominion over men. There'd been a precedent, a ghastly one in the 12th century, when the Empress Matilda tried to wrest the throne from her cousin, King Stephen, and the Londoners kicked her out because she was so arrogant. Nowadays, we might say she was feisty and hands-on and, you know, very capable woman, but they certainly didn't in the 12th century. Anyway, with that example, it was seen as disastrous in England. Catherine came from a very different background because her mother, Isabella of Castile, was a queen in her own right and had ruled jointly and very capably and effectively with Catherine's father, Ferdinand of Aragon. And so Catherine probably couldn't see any reason why her own daughter, who was intelligent and well-educated, could not rule, you know, after Henry died. So therein, you know, lies the problem.
Well, and irony of ironies,
yes,
that his second daughter
yes.
was one of the greatest queens we've ever had.
I know. I would love him to have been able to see that and prove a point.
Yes, exactly. Just to prove, we're bringing you back from the dead.
Just to do that. Yes,
just to prove the point.
What would he have said? It's amazing. And of course, never afterwards was there any controversy about a queen ruling.
And we've had our own glorious queen there for quite some time
we
now.
We have indeed, yes.
I'm a big fan of Queenie.
Me too, and Queen Victoria. I think we have mm-hmm. some very good examples. And mm-hmm. The English have been successful with queens.
More so, I would say, than the troublesome kings, Henry being a prime example.
Yes, exactly.
Troublemaking.
Yes, absolutely.
So the book is written chronologically.
Yes, it is.
And the events occur exactly as they would have occurred for Catherine.
Yes.
And therefore, we really see it from her perspective. Was that your primary intention?
That was my brief, basically. That we follow a strict chronological narrative, and that it's each novel in these series is from that particular queen's point of view only. And that allows a very different perspective mm-hmm. on the subject, and it makes the novels feel rather different.
Very different.
And you have to ask yourself all the time you're writing, what would she have known? How much would she have known? How would she have found out? And there's a sort of dramatic irony that runs through the books, because there's some things that Catherine won't know, but Anne Boleyn will know. And likewise, as we go on through the series, there are also going to be linked e-shorts that give backstories. And so that allows for a different perspective. The first one, The Prince of the Roses, about Prince Arthur's story, up until the moment he meets Catherine. And there's another one coming out next spring called The Blackened Heart, on which I'm not going to elaborate.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station, where you'll only hear the female voice.
Talk to me about that beginning part of her life with Arthur.
This is where the new research comes into play, because they married in 1501 when she was 16 and he was 15. And they lived together basically for 6 months. That was the marriage only lasted. He died in April 1502. And there's been a lot of talk and debate over the years as to why what he died of. The traditional theory was tuberculosis. There's been suggestions of the sweating sickness, the plague, testicular cancer even. But there, new evidence emerged quite recently, and it wasn't my research. It was Patrick Williams, who spent 10 years researching a biography of Catherine. He's a Spanish specialist, and he looked into the Spanish archives. Now, most British historians writing about Catherine think that the documents of state papers, the Spanish calendar that are printed, are exhaustive. They're not. Patrick Williams found new evidence, and he found the testimony of Catherine's own physician, who testified that Arthur was in the last stages of consumption, or phthisis as he'd called it, and he lacked the strength and vigour to know a woman. The marriage was not consummated, he said it categorically. We also have the testimony of Catherine's maid of honour the day after the wedding night. When Catherine was in seclusion, Catherine was very down. She confided to this maid, Arthur hadn't consummated the marriage, and she doubted he ever would. And so that puts a very different complexion on what comes later. And I too did research to show that Arthur did not just have this short final illness, but it had a lifelong predisposition to ill health. He was weak to begin with. He was premature.
Unlike the vigorous
Henry, yes.
So you have written about her before and yes. these women and this period. What brought you back to this?
I published a biography of the Six Wives of Henry VIII in 1991, and it dawned on me. I've published various books since on Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII and his court, Mary Boleyn. And it dawned on me that I'd done a lot of new research. Other people had done a lot in the time since then. And, of course, every book is a contribution to a debate at a given time. And I thought, I'd really love to revisit the Six Wives. So I managed, would you believe I did it on a typewriter originally? Just too soon for, you know, Word documents. And I managed to get back the text electronically. And so I was able to work on it. So it's much, much easier. And I started to go through it, looking at the sources again. And my original version had been so much longer with so much more source material. And so I was getting new perspectives, looking at the sources from a more mature viewpoint after having, you know, researched for many years, this original research done in the 70s. And getting new theories, and you know, there were some new things emerging, and thinking, oh, God, it's going to be years before I can publish this because it's such a big project. And anyway, I was in my agent's office. We were thinking about where I was going with the next fiction. We talked about three books on Richard III and the Plantagenets. And I'm sitting there thinking, do I want to live with this for the next few years? And suddenly this idea came, six novels on the wives of Henry VIII. I could use that new research. And it would be a rather different project. And I thought, no, nobody would take six novels. And also there'd been loads of books on the wives of Henry VIII. But nevertheless, I said to my agent, I said, I've had this other idea. And he said, oh, yes. And I told him what it was, and his eyes just lit up. And he said, well, I know what I can sell them more easily. And he did. There was a lot of interest. And I'm hugely grateful that Headline commissioned the books, because they are a wonderful publisher. And I'm not just saying that because I'm sitting in their offices, because they have been. It's been a wonderful experience to publish with them. They're enthusiastic, zestful, and so creative.
And it struck me that this period of time, the reign of Henry VIII, also Britain becomes recognisably modern Britain at that time.
Yes,
the seeds are sown.
We come into, effectively, we're still living in the England of Henry VIII, effectively. Civil service, the administration, the counties, you know, bringing Wales into the administrative system. And, of course, the establishment of the Church of England, which wasn't Protestant, of course, under Henry, but it's still the Church of England, and the basic framework is there. It becomes Protestant under Elizabeth I. And, so basically we are seeing a very different England. We are seeing the modern state emerging from a medieval kingdom.
Absolutely, absolutely, which is why I think it is endlessly fascinating.
So do I.
To us.
Yes,
you
it
know.
Is. And Catherine is the last true medieval queen of England. She conforms to all these traditional ideals, and she's effectively the very mirror of the Virgin Mary, as medieval queens were meant to be. But she fails in this one huge issue, and that is to bear Henry a son. And of course, if you look at the queenship in that context, you look at the context of Henry's
that was
mother,
your job.
Elizabeth of York, this is the ideal they have conformed to. Anne Boleyn comes along, she's completely radical, and you can see why she shocked a lot of people and why she was controversial.
Yes. Yeah, she was the wag.
Yeah, you could say that.
Busting in with her French ways.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And that would have upset Catherine to start with, because France was the great enemy of Spain.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Yes, well, and she felt, and Catherine, going back to this, you know, and I like the idea that she was the last stalwart of the medieval age.
Yes.
And we always think of, you know, sort of, you know, the Renaissance and everything post-medieval is being, you know, good. Not to her.
No, that's true. I mean, if you can look, it's sort of left-wing and right-wing. You can almost see it in those terms. And she is seeing the world that she... I mean, she has been brought up under the ideal of the Christian Republic of Europe, an indivisible Europe sharing set... It conforms to the order of society that's divinely ordained by God. And this is, you know, this heresy... She is seeing, you know, the new ideas, the Protestant faith emerging, radicalism at the English court, evangelism. She's everything. The world's been turned upside down, and she thinks it is a serious canker in the body politic. Put it like that.
she does. I love you putting it like that.
Thank you. Well, that's how she sees it, and she is terrified for it. She's terrified for the church, for the ordinary people of England, whose salvation, basically, she sees to be at risk.
And for Spain.
Yes, and for Spain, of course. I mean, but of course, Spain champions the traditional religion. So Spain becomes, you know, the ideal for her. And that's why she's always looking to Spain for support. And of course, the King of Spain at that time was her nephew, who also happened to be the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. And he's amazingly powerful. And it's because he backs Catherine, although he never actively does very much, apart from, you know, moaning at the Pope. But because of that, Catherine is feared. Because if she crooked her little finger, he might well have come with an army.
Which, of course, her enduring love of Henry...
She would not do it.
And
it was against her marriage
adopted, vows. Yeah, exactly. And her adopted country,
exactly.
she wouldn't do it.
No, that's right.
She would never do
it. She wouldn't, no. Although the Spanish ambassador, Chapuis, urged her again and again, and rather overestimated the amount of support that she could probably command here. But he'd probably been talking to all, you know, very friendly with all her partisans.
Yeah, because while they did support her and didn't want her, I mean, they're
it's
supporting. Yeah, exactly.
Against the king.
Yeah. Supporting her is one thing, but then when you're attacking us, that's an entirely different story.
Absolutely, yes. And of course, Henry couldn't really proceed against her because if she wasn't his wife, as he insisted, she wasn't his subject.
That was a neat trick.
Yeah, both ways.
Yeah, so she was, and it struck me that through this. That she was she seemed an intelligent woman.
Oh, she was, undoubtedly. She was very learned. In fact, the great Dutch scholar Erasmus thought her scholarship was better than Henry's.
Wow.
So, oh yes, she was very learned, and she was acclaimed in the universities. She visited Merton College and was, you know, lauded there. And she was very literate. She also was at the forefront of educational ideas for her daughter, this great Spanish educationist, Juan Luis Vives, was under her patronage, and he wrote a book for her daughter's education.
Amazing. Again, the inner workings of the court and how isolated she became.
Yes.
And how long things took.
Oh, yes, I know. Well, I mean, we have email.
Yes, exactly.
I've really snail mail.
Yes, exactly. So get her on a boat and then put it here, and then a guy walks over here. And then...
I think the waiting... There was once a wonderful observation I read in a book on Catherine. It was a novel, and it said that they could put on her tomb, she waited. And that's basically what her life was, because the worst thing to wait for was what was the Pope. She could not understand why he would not pronounce this marriage valid, because he was frightened of alienating Henry further. Because the longer it went on, the more Henry was pulling away and getting angry. But even so, the Pope would not relent, and in the end, of course, he pronounced in Catherine's favour, and it was too late. That's the great tragedy. You can imagine how she felt, and I have imagined in the book, you know, getting that news, I am the true queen, I've been acknowledged, and then realising in, sort of, in a drip-feed sort of way, Henry isn't going to take any notice. It must have been crushing.
Yeah, that she'd pinned all of her hopes on that.
Yes, she did, and when it did come, and when she was vindicated, Henry had gone too far.
Yeah.
Because it does look, I'm almost certain that for a time, and I'm sure Catherine thought this, and I think Anne Boleyn in the second book is thinking it too, you know, they're thinking it in different ways. You know, Henry is still hanging on. He's still hoping with a compact with the Pope. Catherine's praying for it. Anne Boleyn is thinking, oh, for God's sake, be done with it and break away, you know, that kind of thing. But that, I think he hung on and hung on, and it was just that bit too late.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous. There for you.
Because he did want, on the one hand, he's the king and he wants what he wants, but he also wants it to be legit. He's got to sell it.
Exactly, exactly. He can't really risk a disputed succession, which, you know, was basically what happened.
Yes.
You know, would that be with Elizabeth? I mean, she was never declared legitimate. Mary was, Catherine's daughter, but Elizabeth never was. Mm. They said she wanted to. To have an Act of Parliament passed, but they advised her, oh no, don't break up the scandals of your mother's fall.
Mm.
You know? And there were so many. The majority of Christian Europe saw Elizabeth as a bastard and Mary as the true heir. And of course they supported the Pope's decision.
Yeah. And everybody seemed sort of, you know, pulled in different directions and stuck. And as you say, Catherine, you know, she waited to marry Arthur. She waited to, you know, because they waited. And then she waited forever to marry Henry, which probably didn't help with the baby plans.
That was awful. Yeah. Exactly, because she was 24 when they married, and that's rather late at that time
for a woman to be having,
given the pains and perils of childbirth, it's rather late for a woman to be started. And of course, we know what happened. Tragic obstetric record.
Yes. I was, because I didn't realise that she had given birth to a son who lived for a short time.
Probably two lived. One may have been stillborn, then we got conflicting reports.
Yeah.
And it's tragic that there were three sons and three daughters. And if they'd all lived, just think how strong her position would have been. And Henry's. He would have had three sons, an heir and a spare, and then daughters to make alliances with.
Exactly, and had as many affairs as he...
Well, he did. As soon as his wives were pregnant, that was the signal. The sex is to be in pregnancy. I'm free now. You know,
excellent.
It doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't count.
Exactly. Well, and he did have sons. That was another thing that came up, that he did have a son.
He did,
but
yes.
Not a legitimate
heir. I know, none of his legitimate sons lived. Anne Boleyn had two, or one, almost certainly two, and possibly a third, because it was so hush-hush. What happened to these pregnancies? The only legitimate son, what Henry didn't know, was Edward VI, and he died at 15. Fortunately, Henry didn't know that he was going to catch what may well have been TB again.
Yeah. Well, and Henry was so petrified of the plague and everybody, this entire massive household moving all around. And
he was, absolutely. And not only that, when his son was born, the orders were that the floors and the walls and the ceilings of Prince's apartments had to be washed down three times a day and swept. Can you imagine? I mean, these are big apartments. Because they didn't understand how infection spread. You know, there were lots of old wives' tales. And Henry was a hypochondriac. Mm. He makes loads of his own medicines. He was obsessive about health. And he could understand it. You know, in an age when he's got no son, he's not allowed to go on a crusade. They worry about him going jousting because he hasn't got a son to succeed him, and the succession is all important.
And the manly pursuits, you know.
Well, exactly. He felt
hunting and jousting.
Well, he did it anyway. Yeah. And he did come off and landed on his head once, and you know, his visor was nearly pierced, and that. You know, he took risks, but that's what men did. You know.
Yeah. Well, and I'm the king. I should be able to do whatever I want.
Well, he did in the end.
Yeah,
didn't listen to his counselors, no.
So when you moved on from Catherine to Anne Boleyn and so on, do you feel, because I get the sense that you're very sympathetic towards Catherine.
Yes. But if I'm writing it from her point of view, it's bound to be. Every single one of these novels will probably be sympathetic.
I was going to say, but do you feel like you're cheating on Catherine when you pick up with Anne?
No, I don't know, because there again you have to sort of get inside her head, and that's much more difficult, because we can know Catherine in a way we don't know Anne Boleyn, because we've got so many of her letters, which are quoted in here, And so much of her personal feelings she reveals in her letters. We feel we can know her. There's a lot that comes across. With Anne Boleyn, we don't have that rich documentation. Mm. We've very few personal letters, very few letters at all, actually.
Why don't we have her letters?
Well, she must have kept them. They were stolen from her when the papal legate came to England, 1528-29. When he went home, they were missing. Now, apparently the baggage was searched at Dover, but they weren't found. So where were they? How did they get to the Vatican Library? It's been conjectured that's what happened. So they were probably stolen from her, probably with the connivance of one of her servants. Henry would have kept her letters. So that's what's missing. Will they ever turn up one day? My God, they're the sources I'd love to see.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
Well, that leads me nicely into, do you remember what first lit your fire for history?
Yes, my mother marched me into a library when I was 14 and said, get a book. And because I graduated from books to pop magazines and things. And so I was at that old library. I'm walking around totally bored. And this lurid cover drew my attention, this book, Henry's Golden Queen, by an author with a wonderful name of Lasagna Prohl, and who also wrote as Ursula Bloom. And I thought, well, this is interesting. It's about Catherine of Aragon. And, of course, I devoured it in 2 days. I was absolutely agog. And this passion for history was literally born overnight. I had to rush off to my school library, up the City of London School, just up the road from here, actually, and find out what really happened. And I think I've been doing that ever since.
I would say, and your mother must have been like, damn, I'm good.
She was smug. Yeah, she was very encouraging. Was it like that? She was marvellous. There wasn't a lot of money, and what there was, you know, she'd take me out to Hampton Court and down to Hever Castle, you know, and that's a, you know, she really encouraged it. She was, and she still does now.
I was going to say, she must be proud.
Oh, she is.
Oh, she must be like, exactly, yeah, preening. I can see her preening now.
She's lovely. She's very, very kind. That's why I've dedicated the book to her.
Oh, she was. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, and what started your passion for writing? Because you're incredibly well-selling and prolific. And
well, just reading around. I loved historical novels as well. I started reading. I wrote my first biography when I was 15. It was of Anne Boleyn. Because I started to read all these historical sources and thought, I want to have a go at that. And then I wrote loads of things. I wrote plays, I wrote lots of poetry, and I wrote lots of historical novels and historical
Your mother
projects.
Created a monster.
She did. Royal family trees on rolls of wallpaper, all that kind of thing. Oh, yes, I know. My school friends, you can imagine what they thought about me. Anorak, you know.
Swap, yes.
And so it went from there. And then I read Antonia Fraser's Mary, Queen of Scots, which was huge at that time. And it was historical biography as I thought it should be. It was a new departure. And I wanted to be the new Antonia Fraser. That when I was very young at that time. And it was something I never lost sight of. I started to do historical projects, and then I got rejection, then I got demoralised and didn't finish things. So I ended up with a huge bank of research and information that, you know, that was just sitting there, and which I've taken full advantage since. And I'm actually, for this non-fiction project I'm not allowed to discuss, I'm writing up the last huge bank of research.
So how exciting.
It is exciting.
And where do you, for the most part, on all of these things you've done historically a lot of research along the way, but what are some of your wonder sources?
Well, I have to say, I mean they're virtually the same sources for each book. If you're talking about the Tudor period, you used to have to delve through libraries for like the letters and papers of the reign of Henry VIII, which is in something like 38 volumes. They're online. It's wonderful.
Ooh.
It's magical. It's this amazing site called british-history.ac.uk, and it's run by the Institute of Historical Research, and it's full of all these sources. You don't have to move. You can just sit there and they're all at your fingertips. Some of them you have to access by subscription, but it's magical. It really is.
Yeah, you just have a wander through whatever.
Absolutely.
Of course, takes
your main thing is some of them are in abstract. So if you want to see the original, you then have to trawl along to the British Library or wherever else, you know, they might be.
Well, it's good to get out every once in a while.
And then you find you can't read the document because it's so faded. You think, God, this must have been transcribed donkeys years ago, you know, because somebody could read it then and they've left out the important bits.
Is it do historical objects like the letters themselves or the jewellery?
Oh, yes. I mean, there isn't much jewellery, tragically. I mean, there's the wonderful Lennox jewel, which is in Holyrood House, and, you know, that's a royal jewel from the 16th century, and it's amazing. the symbolism. But no, the letters. I remember once I spoke at the National Archives at Kew, and I was speaking on Elizabeth I. This is the late 90s. And when I got in there, they had put out one of the dresses Glenda Jackson had worn in the Elizabeth R series, but also his last letter, the last letter Robert Dudley wrote to Elizabeth, was on display, and it's very fragile. And I couldn't believe, because I was actually going to refer to it in the talk, and I couldn't believe I was speaking in the same room. I went a bit all gooey, you know. That's what historians are very peculiar at times.
Well, but I think you just described it perfectly, because it was as if you were in the room with him.
And well, like, they had both touched this.
Yeah.
And it linked these two people about whom we've endlessly speculated. They're so famous. This relationship, did they, didn't they? Which everybody wants to know. But it was just, this is this last tangible link between them. And that letter is so poignant. And she kept it in her casket after he died, just after he'd written it. And he was just going away to take the water. She didn't expect him to die. And she was not for six. And she kept this in her casket by her bedside. And she'd written it on herself, his last letter. And they found it at her death. And they brought it out specially. So that was, it's a very important document.
You've transmitted the goosebumps.
No, thank you.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
Can I ask, do you have a favourite queen of Henry's?
Probably Catherine of Aragon. Because, as I say, she's a strong woman and I admire that. She's got great integrity and principle. She's warm, she's loving, she's kind. I mean, she has so many virtues. Some people would say, oh, she should have been more pragmatic. It would have been better for her and her daughter. That's a very modern view. It doesn't take account of the fundamentalism of the 16th century.
Absolutely. She's, you know, well, and also to deny that marriage and to plunge her as living in sin.
That's how she would have seen it.
Yes.
See, we pay any account to that, you know.
I was going to say, well, because divorce as she had the first one.
Absolutely. You know, yes.
It but went on from there.
When I was first researching in the 60s, you could, living in sin had a far more severe connotation then than it will now. And it's hard to get a modern reader to appreciate how that would have been so much further back.
You know? Well, and also, I mean, there were so many wars. There was, I mean, as we were saying, we could have fought, we could all be speaking Spanish. We could have fought a big war over this. And,
yes.
You know, becoming Protestant, Luther was considered, you know, this horrible heretic, books
yes.
banned.
Yes.
And you have to say, if people were going to war over it, they were really pretty excited about it. And I think it's easy to see where we are today with that.
I think that since 2001, since 9/11, people have understood fundamentalism better. It's easier to explain mm-hmm. the religious divide of the 16th century and why people were prepared to go to the stake. For denying the real presence, and it's quite scary. And when you've got a society like that, you can understand where Catherine is coming from in taking her stand, because she thought she too might end up going to the fire, because that was the penalty for women in treason. Because of course Henry would have had it both ways, you know.
Yes.
She would have argued the point, but she maintained she was his wife, so she was then laying herself liable to the punishments for treason. And when her confessor was sentenced to be burned at the stake, and the letters, which I paraphrased in here because they're very long, she was almost envious of him, having that terrible death, but it's going to give him immortal life and martyrdom. You know?
At least his soul is safe.
And you go on, and I will follow, you know.
It's
a mindset that's very alien.
Mm.
And that's why you cannot see her taking a pragmatic view, because that would be wrong in her eyes.
It would refute her entire life.
It would. And had she done that, her daughter would still have been deprived of her right in the succession. She would have still kept her place, because she'd been born in marriage made in good faith. But she would have been after any children of a second marriage. And for Catherine, that's considering the second marriage will be with Anne Boleyn, that's anathema.
Well, and also, poor Mary, what a miserable life. That's
awful. I have to say, I identified with that madly, because my parents split up when I was 11, a very similar triangular situation. And I saw my mother, a very strong and resolute woman, coping with it almost in the same way Catherine did. So when I read about Catherine afterwards, it rang so many bells. But that's not to say I don't like Anne Boleyn because of that, because I had a very romantic idea of her when I was much younger. I don't have that romantic idea now because I've done so much more research. And but she's become a celebrity, and so many people project their own expectations onto her, and that does worry me. One time you do an Anne Boleyn image search on Google, and you get loads of portraits, and then you get Natalie Dormer and Natalie Portman, and, you know, all these sort of little artwork that's all based on the Tudors and that, and you know, she's got fan clubs online. That scares me.
Yes, because, you know, take it a little further, girls.
Yeah, she's the new Richard III. Mm. You're not allowed to have a bad opinion about her. So it was a challenge to write the book and make her sympathetic. But I talked to my editor here and said, I am having this because there are certain sources I just cannot get over them. And she said, well, if you can show why she behaved the way she did, because she was scared, or then in that case, you can go with it. And I did that. Very wise advice. And it works. My agent said it's a sympathetic book.
Alison, thank you so much.
Thank you, Donna. It's been a pleasure.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.